And we will go on to case number two. And that is Appeal 083744, Tommy Brown versus Richard Schneider. Good morning, Mr. Rosen.
Very good, Your Honor. Very good. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mark Rosen appears on behalf of the petitioner appellant, Tommy Brown, who is asking this Court basically for a relief for issues that were done with respect to his hearing for his putting him in secure detention, the 360 days at a secure facility, and thereby adding 177 days to his sentence, his confinement. The basic first issue we've got, which is basically the first issue that I think is presented and is probably the main issue before the Court, is the issue of the second tape that we feel and was wrongfully and has been wrongfully denied to my client as material exculpatory evidence. He has repeatedly requested the production of that tape for an in-camera, either an in-camera view or production at various levels throughout his hearings to ask to have that reviewed because it is our perception, it's our position that that is exculpatory and therefore should be reviewed pursuant to the case law of this circuit. In various case laws, I've cited that in my brief.
The other transcripts you cited in the briefs are made in both briefs. I assume there were some of the conversations were transcribed.
I don't think there were anything transcribed. My perception of looking at the record, Your Honor, is that what they went on is that Captain Muraski basically got on and said, "This is what I heard." So
what's transcribed in the briefs are the transcription from the hearing itself, not transcriptions of any recorded conversations.
That's correct. And Captain Muraski's basically his recollection was that basically he didn't even recall what happened in the second tape. And my client's position is that the second tape, his wife basically says, "I want out of the conspiracy. I'm not going to go along with this." And basically, you need to get a search warrant, which basically defeats the whole purpose and the whole issue of what he was there for with respect to the conspiracy.
What would be the Supreme Court case that entitles him to a copy of this of his telephone conversation, with his wife? Given that the disciplinary committee itself didn't listen to any tape or chant, and given that Mr. Brown and his wife were parties to the call and could offer their own testimony or a declaration as to what was, what was contained in the call and what they said, why did due process entitle him to access to the tape?
Well, first of all, I think Wolf versus McDonald basically indicates that there are due process rights, a liberty interest, a constitutionally protected liberty interest with respect to the time. He's got that due process rights. And then we get into the case law that this court that talks about Brady and Giglio is basically talking about how there's exculpatory evidence. I think it's Chavez versus Rao talks about how you have a right to exculpatory evidence, as Brady, Giglio sort of exculpatory evidence is an issue and is entitled to. These prisoners have a right to that sort of evidence.
So in other words, there is not a particular Supreme Court case that you were able to find that would give him this particular right under these particular situations.
I think basically when you take all the case law in Wolf versus McDonald and all this other case law, I think, but specifically on this, I couldn't find a specific case on this, but just arguing and then looking at Chavez and the other case law presented. And as far as the other issue you presented, Your Honor, about the why couldn't my client just a declaration or an affidavit from his wife, they presented various those. Those were presented to the court. To the hearing board, and they were basically disregarded. She presented three affidavits, three declarations to the court, which were totally disregarded. They basically, the hearing examiner basically just went with Captain Muraski's recollection, so to speak. I use that word in quotes, and his statements as opposed to and totally disregarded her affidavit. So I think when the magistrate Gorenz comes forth and says, well, they could have submitted the affidavit talking about that, that is, as I've indicated in my briefs, simplistic. It's just not realistic, given the fact that I can see there's credibility issues, but it just doesn't cut the mustard, especially when, as I'm presenting in my briefs, under the case law I've argued, there is a right to get this exculpatory evidence and have it presented fair play. I think there was talks about in the case law that's presented, but where they have a right to fair play, a right to basically get a look at the evidence, a right to present a defense, and that is basically all cited in the case law. They have a right to present this evidence and to get this evidence, and if he's raising the issue that the tape is going to contradict what Captain Muraski says, and they're not listening to the tape, wanting to hear the tape, and just going on the reliance of what Captain Muraski says, I think that that becomes a violation of the law, as is basically outlined in the case law that's provided by the Supreme Court cases that I've cited, Your Honor, as well as the Seventh Circuit cases that are presented before the court. So I think clearly an in-camera review of the second tape, it's clear the second tape is the issue here. It's a tape where his wife says, I'm not going to be part of this, and we need to get a warrant. Basically pulling out a conspiracy and taking away that whole conspiracy allegation is kind of the issue here.
Well, there's also the issue of the fact that it would seem there was sufficient evidence for the Department of Corrections finding that he lied when questioned about the mail. You have viewing the evidence favorable to DOC. He just lied when he said he had no idea how Zinders got his name. His wife prepared and mailed the letter at his instruction and evidently signed Zinder's name to it.
Well, he had a different recollection. He had a different perception as to that. He indicated that basically our position is that in the Department of Corrections code that they have the Department of Corrections has the burden of proof by preponderance of the evidence to prove their case. And that his position is that he didn't lie. He answered Captain Muraski's questions. He asked him those two questions, and he answered them truthfully.
Are you getting into the idea of an ambiguity and term engage in the code? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I was talking about basically the issue of the lying, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
Basically that where Captain Muraski says, I asked him about this, and I thought he lied about how he got the address, the name, and then the petitioner stated, well, that's my – he was asked how he got the address, and he got the address from the wife, and that sort of thing. There was two questions asked, two questions truthfully answered, and he admitted that he got that. So there was no lying, and it's basically his word against Captain Muraski. And there was basically – and so then it becomes the issue of the burden of proof and the issue of sufficiency of the evidence with respect to that, that he did not lie, and that there is not enough evidence in the record to support a conclusion that he knowingly lied. And so that's basically our position with that, is that that there is not enough evidence on that level. As far as the issue of the engages, I think if you were going to get to that, Your Honor.
Oh, I wasn't sure if you were getting to
it. Just following up with your comment. He was basically arguing, and has argued throughout this hearing and throughout the situation, that the term engages is ambiguous, is when you look at the terms in the dictionary. And I provided those various definitions in my brief, and that the Department of Corrections rule does not specify how the term engages is to be used or entitled, so he did not have a due process right to present a defense in terms of that, and he used, because it's too vague, it was too vague of a situation there for him to be able to analyze. And there was there was a lack of clarification.
How can it be vague? I mean, the code prohibits an inmate from engaging in a business or enterprise, whether or not for profit. I mean, in context, the term engage has a readily understood meaning, you know, to begin or carry on, to involve oneself in a business.
But under the terms of the definitions that were provided, there are various definitions, involve, ensnare. There's different interpretations can be created by the use of each interpretation of the word, so therefore you have a distinction where he is not entitled, he can't present his defense because he doesn't have a solid definition of what the word engages means.
Ensnare is only age to be married.
I'm not going to go there.
No, okay.
But it's just that it's out there, and it basically is creating an ambiguity. And under Wolf versus McDonald, he has a due process right to present a defense, and he isn't able to present that because he doesn't have that specific definition that he can rely upon to form his defense. And therefore, it's it, it, wasn't it's not sufficient, Your Honor. So I'm going to save the time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Right, Ms. Potts, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Abigail Potts, and I am here on behalf of the respondent, Mr. Schneider.
Can you explain how I understand all the telephone calls from Waupun in and out are recorded.
Correct. Now,
here there were 75 or 76 calls during a two-month just between the Browns. How many calls are there in a two-month period? This is one prisoner, 76 calls are recorded. I'm just trying to understand the scope of how you keep track of these things or how somebody would find in any one day or something where the Browns' conversations are as opposed to everybody else's using that payphone out in the hall.
No, that's a good question. I don't exactly know how these were identified. You're asking how Officer Muraski identified these calls.
Yeah, sometimes he listened to the record. I mean, nobody's listening to it while it's being, I don't think, while the conversation's actually taking place.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they do. It's possible there was reason for him to go back and kind of look for these calls if he had gotten, I'm not sure because I'm not sure if the record speaks to this, but there could have been, could have gotten some evidence that these prohibited acts were going on and went and.
Well, I mean, how do you know that? I just
they're all
curious.
Archived.
How do you, they are?
They are. From what I understand, they are archived, and that is one reason that the calls there weren't transcripts provided at the beginning because they were very long and they were all archived in the system.
So there are no time limits.
You want to say in February of 2004. On February 13th of 2004, there was a conversation between the Browns. How do you ever find something like that?
I'm not sure how they're organized. I imagine they probably are organized in some manner so they could go and retrieve calls, but I don't know.
But do they say that they have to say their name or something so somebody would know that inmate Brown made a call on that day?
I would assume they are organized for security purposes because there are security reasons why they would want to know who is calling whom and what they're saying. That's probably why they're also archived. So, and I can't answer your question explicitly on that, but I imagine they are organized in a manner that they can be identified.
But following up on that, somehow he found these conversations.
Correct.
Where the process was.
And that's not in dispute.
With regard to second conversations, the only way I know how to characterize it, because that's how the brief characterizes it, there's two different versions of that conversation. One is the version that the petitioner gives, and one's the version that Officer Murkowski gives, which are a little diametrically opposite of each other. Let's say a review of that single conversation indicates the petitioner was correct and Murkowski was completely wrong. Wouldn't that affect possibly Murkowski's credibility far beyond that? Because there's a number of conversations that he had with the petitioner, including the one about the line and so forth, that were one-on-one conversations. There was nobody else in the room when they took place. Wouldn't that possibly affect the credibility determination regarding Officer Murkowski?
If that were true, that's a possibility. I think it's our position here before this court that that's outside the scope of why we're here. And that brings me to the two points, general points I would like to address today, the first of which is that the standard established by the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, the AEDPA, does apply to Mr. Brown's writ petition because Wisconsin state law provides for judicial review through state courts of prison disciplinary decisions. And the second point I want to make is that with that standard in mind, this court should affirm the district court because the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision in no aspect violates clearly established federal law or the highly deferential standard of the AEDPA.
Before you go into your argument, I do have one question, and it's this. If a key conversation has been recorded, and it turns out that, you know, every conversation is recorded, and a prisoner says it's exculpatory, then why isn't he entitled to production of the tape? The tape itself would be much more probative than anything he or any other witness might say about the tape. Wouldn't it be? And, I mean, you've got them. So, obviously, you've got them. I just don't understand that.
Well, and I think, although, I think generally speaking, you make a good point, and I know and I acknowledge that the circuit has extended the Brady rule to the prison disciplinary proceeding. However, in this case, the board did not rely on any tape. We're talking about just basically a conduct report that's very similar in a lot of ways to other conduct reports.
Well, they did find that he lied. And part, as I understand that, and again, if I'm wrong, I apologize, but as I understand that, part of that came from a one-on-one interview that Officer Murkowski had with the petitioner. Am I correct?
Correct.
Well, what if in that second tape, and I agree, if they're just asked, he says, produce every conversation I had, that would be a whole different issue. But they focused on one tape, which in fact was Officer Murkowski found it. And if that tape, where Morris Murkowski said that I listened to the tape and his wife never said we can't do that because that would be illegal and therefore we're stopping this right at this point, he said he didn't hear her say that. She didn't say that. But if you play the tape, she did say that. Doesn't that go to the issue of Officer Murkowski's credibility as these other conversations that he said that he had to extend under the act you're talking about? I understand it limits considerably what you're obligated to do on review of these things. But wouldn't that be important if you found out Murkowski's a liar?
Well, first of all, I want to just clarify that the lying charge does not go to the same claim that relates to the second tape. There's nothing that has been asserted that is in
the No, but part of the conversation that leads to this lying charge is a conversation that Officer Murkowski has with the petitioner. It's a one-on-one meeting.
Right.
It's not a tape conversation. It's a one-on-one meeting. What I'm saying is if Officer Murkowski was wrong about the tape, which he listened to and mischaracterized it, not just a little bit, but big time, couldn't that be considered as maybe affecting what he's saying on the one-on-one interview he has with the petitioner, which is the basis for the allegation of they lied?
Possibly it could. I would say yes, it could. So could an affidavit from Mr. Brown's wife, from Mr. Brown, on that second conversation as well. And that the fact that Mr. Brown had the opportunity to submit affidavits directly contradicting Officer Murkowski's interpretation of the solicitation charge.
I guess where my concern is, and use a very non-legal term, the Browns have a dog in the fight. Murkowski has a dog in the fight. The tape has no dog in the fight. It's what they said. And that's my only concern is, and I don't know where I'm going with it, but that's my only concern is that it seems to me that listening to that tape would have spread a lot of clear law issues regarding the credibility of the parties, because if the tape is exactly as Mr. Officer Murkowski said it was, I think that takes care of that problem.
I get your question. I think it's outside the scope of why we're here. That said, I also believe that the record indicates that Officer Murkowski did not discuss that second tape much. He was interviewed by Mr. Brown about that tape. He responded that he did not hear Mr. Brown's wife say that she needed a court order. He expressed some doubt as to his recollection as to other elements of it, but it wasn't the focus of this conduct report. The focus of the conduct report was the call that he outlines thoroughly in the conduct report, and I don't really think there's much of a dispute as to what was said in that tape. I think that was adequately and accurately transcribed by him. Mr. Brown's claim is that there's another tape that affects the elements of that solicitation violation. That tape was not, he offered no evidence, no affidavit from his wife on the substance of that tape that was at least before the prison disciplinary committee. And now, since we are on habeas corpus review, we are stepping back and this becomes a more of a due process issue. And I think that relates to the fact that Mr. Brown's in-camera review argument is based on an assumption that the deferential standard of the AEDPA does not apply, which it does. And so we're not reviewing the prison disciplinary committee. We're reviewing the state court decision, which is the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision. And I think that just takes us a step back and creates a much more deferential standard of review for us. And we need to look at whether or not that decision violated clearly established federal law. The case that Mr. Brown heavily relies on is the Brady rule and the Piggy case. And the Piggy case was not an AEDPA standard case because state law did not provide for judicial review of prison disciplinary proceedings. So the district court in that case was more directly reviewing the prison commission's findings. Whereas here we're on a much more deferential standard of review. And so the district court properly denied the writ as to that issue because it didn't need to go there. It didn't need to go in and evaluate whether or not more evidence, whether there was any evidence out there that might be exculpatory. That's just way beyond the scope of review for habeas relief. The district court's decision and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision is consistent with federal law as to two other of Mr. Brown's claims as well. It's consistent with federal law as to the sufficiency of the evidence underlying the findings of guilt. Mr. Brown makes two arguments regarding the sufficiency of the evidence underlying the findings that he was found lying and that he was found violating the enterprising regulations. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision does not violate clearly established federal law as to those two claims because there is more than the requisite some evidence in the record to support the findings of guilt. And I think this is an important point that I would like to make here today is kind of to clarify the standard of review on those issues, on the sufficiency of the evidence. The appellant relies heavily on an unpublished state court of appeals case, the Lomax case, for the proposition that there is, at least at this level, we should be looking at the preponderance of the evidence standard. And I think that's just incorrect in this context. And what it does is it fails to recognize the procedural posture of this case and how it has changed. Although it is true that the Wisconsin Administrative Code provides that a finding of guilt be based on a finding that is more likely than not that an inmate committed an act, our review is different now that we are on habeas review, and we are looking at this in the context of the minimum requirements of due process as outlined by the United States Supreme Court. And that's why the applicable standard for the sufficiency of the evidence is some evidence in the record to support the finding. Contrary to Mr. Brown's claims, too, the preponderance of the evidence standard would force this court to go in and weigh the credibility and weight of the evidence before the commission, which I think, you know, relates to some of the questions we had here this morning. But I think that's beyond the scope of the review that we're
under. Let me ask you a question on that point, and I'm not saying this case reaches that, but what if the officer just straight up lied? I mean, not even he just lied. And everybody takes that lie and keeps moving forward to the next step and finally get to where the burden is at this point, which is different than it was before, or the standard review. Is there some inherent unfairness to that?
There could be in a situation that you describe. I think in the case that we have, the lack of evidence rebutting anything that Officer Moraski said is apparent. And I think that's part of the reason the committee was so comfortable with finding guilt on those charges. On habeas review, now here where we are, and the standard for minimum requirements of due process being some evidence in the record, you're right, that's a very deferential standard. And the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear that it is not the reviewing court's job to go back in and find evidence. It's simply to go in and see if there's anything to support it. And I think that's clearly established in all of the findings of guilt in this case. I believe my time is up. So if there's any other questions?
Actually, you have half a minute.
Oh, I have half a minute. Okay.
Plenty of time.
So I guess in that half a minute, I would like to just simply say that we ask this court to affirm the district court's denial of Mr. Brown's writ because the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision clearly does not violate any clearly established federal law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Potts. Mr. Rosen, how many minutes? Five? You have 5 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think I'll be that long. The appellate standard of review for prisoner review cases is whether or not the district court abuses discretion. Whether or not that is the Westerfer case and other case law. So that's basically looking at the district court's ruling and the district court's holding, the modicum of evidence. I can see the point. The thing is that the conduct report was based upon Captain Moraski's, and it's going straight to what Your Honor talked about. Counsel says, well, that's the credibility of Captain Moraski is not before this court. It's something outside this, from what I could gather, what she was saying. But that's not basically the truth, because basically the issue of the lying clearly goes to the credibility of Captain Moraski and basically the evidence as to what was back there and what happened at that time in terms of how the second tape would fall into the purview is for, with respect to the lying charge, which is basically an issue of credibility. And that's basically what we were talking about there in terms of the fact Captain Moraski could have recorded that. He had the ability to tape record that, and he didn't. It was just a one-on-one interview with my client, and they seemed to have differing recollections of what happened. Counsel once again talks about, well, why couldn't they submit the affidavit? We've heard that back and forth. Why couldn't his wife submit an affidavit about the second tape? But she did. She submitted, not about that tape, but she submitted three affidavits, which were all totally disregarded. So I think that is, once again, naive and simplistic to simply say that, well, if she'd submitted an affidavit about that second phone call, it would have been, that would have turned the tide. That would have made the difference.
We'll never know, will we?
Well, that's why I think we should ask the court to have the district court review, do the in-camera review of the of that second phone call, which is what the issue is with which is what we're talking about, Your Honor. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Rosen, you were appointed by the court to take this case, and you have the sincere and deep thanks of this court for doing so and for representing your client so admirably. So, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And, of course, thank you as well. All right. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll go on to case